Hello and welcome to the latest Cooper Talks, and this week's episode, I don't know when I do these, it is kind of random, and apologies for that if you'd rather a weekly one. It sort of comes and goes in waves with me. But yes, welcome to an excruciating Cooper Talks. Well, it begins with E, so that works. And we're going to carry on another one on our Russian series at the moment. And going to be looking at how Russia, having looked at the Civil War last time, how the Civil War led to the development towards totalitarianism under the Bolsheviks. Now, this does go kind of in tandem with the economic policies, particularly the introduction of war communism that Lenin introduced as a style of managing the economy during the Civil War. But I think it's better if I do the economic stuff separately. So it's hard to know what the right order is because they really come together. But I'm going to do the economic ones, economic issues in a future podcast. So today I'm just going to really look at the kind of political maneuverings that came along under the Bolsheviks in the early, well, throughout the period of the Civil War that turned the Bolshevik Revolution and the Bolsheviks into a communist totalitarian regime. Now, I think importantly, we need to start off, what do I mean by a totalitarian regime? If we think about political issues as left-wing and right-wing, people are always talking about left-wing, right-wing. Really, for those of you who are interested in such things, left and right actually just comes from the French Revolution. And the people who sat on the far left in the assembly hall of the speaker, so imagine it as banks of steps, people who sat on the far left wanted extreme change, kind of abolish the monarchy, have the monarchy executed and complete freedom and equality for everyone. Those that sat on the far right, on the opposite side, they kind of said, no, we don't want any change at all. We kind of want to forget there was a revolution and just go back to what it was like before. And people sat there based on their political spectrum. So it would, their position. So it would go from one side to the other. And in the middle, you had the kind of moderates on the centre left and the centre right. So we talk about left and right wing, but really it's just two ends of a spectrum that is divided on a key issue. So in the French Revolution, it was about really political reform. So on the left, extreme left, you had people who wanted huge amounts of political reform, and on the extreme right, people who didn't want reform. And for a long time, that was kind of the liberal versus conservative sides of things. People always find this word amusing, but it really shouldn't be. This goes down to the idea of cleavages in politics. So the issue that people are divided on and kind of the idea that there would be a dominant issue. So later on in the 18th century, 19th century, you get economic divisions. And on that, you'd say at the extreme left, you'd have socialists. Okay. And socialists would almost say, you know, complete wealth redistribution. Everyone gets the same amount economically and it's completely equal for everyone. And at the other end, economically, is kind of free market economics. So, meaning that there's kind of no regulation trade, that you can win big, but there won't be any help if things go wrong. So very much individually focused. So that would be an economic cleavage. And this is where people get a bit confused, because economically, we get the idea that someone like the communists would be obviously very left-wing, economically speaking. But then where do people that you associate as being at the opposite end fit in? So quite often people talk about the Nazi party and fascist parties. Oh, well, they're far right. Yes, in terms of kind of political structure and ideologies, depending on the political division or cleavage, they would be polar opposites. However, in other ways, and economically is quite a good one, and particularly when it gets to control, they're maybe not polar opposites as such. So when we look at the cleavage of government power, government control and authority, you have two ends of a spectrum. At the one end, which we might call the left wing, okay, so it's on the left-hand side here, but it is arbitrary, the left and right, could be up and down, north, south, east, west, it really doesn't matter, it's just two sides of the spectrum. But on what we would normally call the left wing would be complete freedom. Okay, so which is weird because in other contexts you think of it as right wing. This is where it all gets very confusing. But we call it left wing. And at the far end, it'd be almost that there is no government control. I mean, it gets to a form of anarchy, really. That there's no laws, there's no authority, that there is complete and utter freedom. The government has no power over the people. Maybe there is no government at all, which is kind of an idea that Marx had. Marx, although he said that it would take a little bit of time, but Marx's hope that there would be no need for governments. And that was a key part of the Communist Manifesto. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, you have a government that's in total control. Okay, a government that controls every single aspect of your life and existence. Not just laws and what you should do and so on, but controls your jobs, controls where you live, controls what you wear, what you eat, what time you do things, what you can watch, what you can read. Absolute total control. And this is why sometimes people like to say, oh, it's left wing, right wing, it comes around in a circle, and actually you end up with the communists and the Nazis kind of very similar. Well, no, it's not a circle. It just depends which cleavage or which division in politics you're looking at. If we're looking at government control, both are totalitarian regimes and believe in total control by the government. So they're very similar in that sense. Now, most modern democracies, we would say, are kind of somewhere in the centre ground. There's a mixture. So we might say centre-left or centre-right. So a centre-left might be a liberal party might say, OK, we want to give some authority, we want to have some authority. We want to make sure, you know, that there's a police force, that laws are obeyed, that there is some degree of regulation, that we clearly say what people can do and what they can't do. But within that, we're going to give a lot of individual freedoms, and rights are a way of protecting that. Whereas more on the centre right, perhaps you say, well, no, we can't really trust them. We can allow them some freedoms, but we need to control certain other aspects of their lives. And we need to have, you know, laws about restricting speech and safe spaces, maybe about what, you know, substances people can take, what age it is you can drink, what you can see online and so on. So there's kind of a mixture there. Whereas if we go to the extreme end of the spectrum, which we usually call right wing, doesn't really matter. But the extreme end would be total control by the government. And the extreme other end would be basically no government and complete individual freedoms. So when we're talking about a totalitarian regime, we're talking about one where the state has and the government has total control over the citizens and population. Now, I did mention earlier that Karl Marx, who wrote the Communist Manifesto, along with Friedrich Engels, who I always feel sorry for, he always gets left out. People just focus on Marx. But anyway, but the idea behind the Communist Manifesto and Marx's idea was that governments and nation states would disappear after the Communist Revolution, that there would be a transitional period. But because it would be a free and equal society and it would allow people to just live in kind of communities where you just share what you have, what you make with each other and support each other, these sort of ideal communities, there would be no need for governments. And so there would be no sort of need for these laws and restrictions imposed on people. So Marx actually, when you break it down, was not a fan or would not have been a fan of totalitarianism. And he wasn't a fan of nationalism either. Now, this is where Lenin and other Russian communists kind of disagree with Marx, because they like the idea of equality and so on, but they wanted state communism. And the argument here was, they said, right, we want communism now. Communism in Russia, okay? So it's kind of a nationalist form of communism. So rather than international communism, where the idea is that basically, it would spread and countries would cease to exist because people would just be working in their communes. You could have it done by a single nation state. But of course, once you have a nation state, you need to have means of defense and production. You need a government to meet with other governments and so on. So that requires people in control. And Lenin and Trotsky and eventually other key members of the Politburo that will run Russia, and obviously Joseph Stalin later on, and other Soviet era leaders, they're going to take a line of Marx and use that to justify total control over the lives of the people. Now, what Marx said is, in the interim, when you're going through the communist revolution, to sort things out and the mess that would inevitably happen with a revolution, you would have a temporary dictatorship of the proletariat, meaning you'd have a dictatorship of some of the key leading figures within the workers' movement to oversee the change and transition, and they would have to act like a dictatorship to get things sorted out. But once things were sorted out, they would relinquish power and there would be no authority, no control. Now, Lenin justified the introduction of dictatorship, saying, well, this is basically to get us through the revolution, to get us through the civil war and ensure communism is secured across Russia. We need to have this temporary dictatorship of the proletariat. Now, of course, the word temporary just means not permanent, but there isn't necessarily a time scale with that. And Lenin would use it. Now, maybe Lenin did mean in the short term, maybe he meant longer term. But the idea was that in order to secure what they believed would be the ultimate good for the people of Russia, this idealized communist state of full equality and resources shared and so on, in order to achieve that, they would have to act like a dictatorship and have total control over people's lives, because people might object. They might not like some of the things that are going on. You have evidence of that with the Civil War. You have the Greens, you have the Whites, you have middle-class people, upper-class people, even some of the workers and peasants aren't fans of what the Bolsheviks are trying to do. And it's an easy one for the leaders to say. They can say, well, these people just don't understand it, okay? They don't understand that we're doing it for their own good. So we're just going to force it on everyone. But once we've got this idealized society, everyone will be grateful for the efforts we put in and what we achieved. Now, it's up to you to decide the legitimacy of that claim. But that's how they justified it. And that's why Lenin and the form of communism that comes out of it in Russia and into the 21st century is very different from Marx's original version. There are links, but it's not the same. Oh, that's quite a political talk going on there. Anyway, so how does this translate? So we end up in a situation where during the Civil War, in order to ensure Bolshevism will win and that Lenin and Trotsky and their supporters will be in total control and make sure their grand revolution and Bolshevik ideals win, they had to seize total control and use brutal measures, okay, being cruel to be kind, so to speak. And that would lead to a totalitarian dictatorship, which Stalin would then take to a whole new level. And for those of you who study the Cold War and are interested in that, you'll see when you look at the events in the Cold War, there's kind of a conflict across Soviet era leaders, and particularly during the Cold War, with things like the Hungarian Revolution and Prague Spring and so on, where there's a clash between how total the control should be. And there tends to be, you know, people don't like the total control. It's kind of, it doesn't make them love communism, and it's all quite austere and it's limited. And so you get some leaders try and relax the rules and give greater freedom, so to give up some of the total control. And then as soon as they do, people start saying, oh yeah, let's get rid of communism, let's have freedom in the elections and all these sorts of stuff. At which case, usually, the Soviet leader would say, no, squash that down, back to total control, thank you very much. We're obviously not ready to have the freedoms. We don't have communism enough yet. So it kind of is a legacy of what happens during the revolution. So how did the Bolsheviks end up creating a totalitarian state? Well, one of the things they would do quite early on, despite the liberal claims, is they'd start restricting the various freedoms. Okay. Again, this was for a kind of military point of view. They didn't want people traveling around the country. They wanted to ensure their control, and they wanted to make sure there's no opposition, because it's very hard to impose an ideological order when there's lots of opponents telling everyone that you're wrong. So December 1917, one of the decrees, they'll ban all non-Bolshevik or Bolshevik-associated newspapers. So they will restrict the press and make sure only approved information can be given out by official Bolshevik newspapers. They will ban the Cadet Party quite early on, so the rivals from the Constituent Assembly, and arrest its leaders. And eventually, as we mentioned before in a previous podcast, they'll basically start removing all other political parties and banning them, to the point where the only political party that exists is the Bolshevik Party, which will be renamed the Communist Party. And of course, in a one-party state, you have no choice. So even if there were elections, you know, your choice would be Communist A or Communist B. It's not really a choice. So becoming a one-party state is a measure of control. They will also make sure the law is on their side. They would say, well, law courts and, you know, rights and things like that, that's a sign of capitalism and the middle classes. So we're going to abolish that because they might work against us. They might say our takeover was illegal and our methods are illegal. And of course, we're doing the right thing. We fundamentally believe that, would be what Lenin would argue at the time. So they replace them with revolutionary tribunals, which are basically kind of military or revolutionary style courts. They weren't based on evidence and things like that. They basically would judge people based on class, based on suspicion, based on who they were. So oh, I think you look a bit middle class, you're executed or sent to a prison camp or so on. So again, this is going to remove any, not just anyone who actually was an enemy of the Bolsheviks, but anyone who could potentially be an enemy. And that's going to create a culture of fear where people feel they have to be loyal to the Bolsheviks or they're going to be executed. So obviously, as the parties are banned over the course of 1918, the Social Revolutionaries, the Mensheviks, other extreme left, these are not like the right-wing parties, like the All-Russian Party and people like that. These are not the conservatives. These are extreme left wings who in many ways should support the Bolsheviks, but they have slight differences of opinion and ideas, so the Bolsheviks just want to get rid of them. Another group who had sort of been working with the Bolsheviks were the anarchists. They're gone. And eventually by 1921 all political parties are officially banned, although there weren't many left by that point. They also, with the social revolutionaries, they had a show trial or kangaroo court, sometimes called. It's basically when it's all kind of made up and it's put on to be a trial to try and investigate guilt. But the verdict's already known. It's basically to look like you're having a show of a fair and legal trial, but really the outcome's known and it's all just for show. That's why it's called a show trial. And so leading social revolutionaries were put on trial as sort of enemies and traitors of the revolution and sort of middle-class sympathisers. Lenin wanted them to be executed, but also realised that, you know, might not look good, particularly overseas if you go around executing people. So instead, he would deport enemies. So there were lots of Russians who were kind of expelled from the country, deported, sent into exile, and they would go and live elsewhere. So this is where you get a spread of people from Russia. And they're not necessarily Tsarist supporters or anyone like that. Some of them are quite left-wing, and they want to go elsewhere. Not that everyone wants them, because people aren't quite sure about left-wing sympathisers at this stage. Anyway, this is part of the process towards a total control, okay, by a single party and a single leadership. Now, in order to do this, what you really need is a kind of military wing, if you like. If you've ever read Animal Farm, which I do recommend you do, which is a parable about all of this, it's you need your attack dogs, okay? You need your vicious people who will kind of impose things for you. And early on, under Lenin, this would be the Cheka. Now, the Cheka, it's a shortening of the Extraordinary Commission to Combat Counter-Revolution, Sabotage and Speculation. Phew, there's a mouthful. We'll just stick with Cheka. So that was set up early doors, December 1917, and basically mirrored the Okhrana, okay, the Tsarist secret police. It would basically go around arresting any opponents. It would ban any demonstrations against the Bolsheviks. So again, making sure loyalty and there was no visible opposition. It was extremely aggressive and brutal. Anyone they considered an enemy of the revolution, and you didn't need proof or evidence here, would be executed. Okay? And they'd just be shot in the back of the head. Boom, done. No trial, no appeals, nothing like that. If the Cheka thought you might be an enemy, that was it. You were done for. It would also run political prisons for re-education. And it was, lots of people will end up there. And quite often these prisons will then feed into, well, they were basically concentration camps, but prison camps, labour camps in Siberia, where these prisoners would be forced to go to work and build and develop new towns and cities, but with very little support, if any. It wasn't a death sentence, but it might as well have been for many people. So huge number of prison complexes and labour camps. So the Cheka was responsible for filling these. These would become known as the gulags under Stalin, but they have their roots in the Cheka. During the Civil War. So the Cheka was really important during the Civil War to remove any potential opposition, any sympathisers of the whites. And I'm not saying it's a good thing, but they were very effective at doing this. Okay, they really did eradicate and crush all the opposition. Even people who might have been willing to voice their opinions or might have been critical kept quiet because they were so scared by the prospect of the Cheka and being denounced. Quite often it was just based on social status rather than anything you might actually have done. So really there was nothing you could do if you were seen as being middle class, if you had in the past been a priest or a noble or even a slightly wealthier peasant, okay, someone who maybe owned a bit of land. That was enough for you to be seen as an enemy and you would just be executed. The justification was they were enemies of the revolution and for the greater good, you needed to get rid of them. But yeah, there really wasn't a lot of justice or fairness here. Now, eventually the Cheka will be renamed the GPU, so the State Political Directorate. And then in 1923, the GPU will become the OGPU, the All Union State Political Directorate. And it will go through various incarnations, but particularly in the Cold War era later on, it will have been renamed and become the KGB. Okay, so that's what it is, the secret police. So the Cheka is a means of really, really brutal control, particularly under its head Felix Drzinski, who ironically was noble. He came from a noble Polish family, he ends up becoming a communist and ends up becoming commander of the Cheka. He fully embraced organized terror and fear to take control, and he really backed Lenin. So he really introduced torture and stuff. Okay, now in February 1918, to take this further, the Bolsheviks passed a new decree, called the Socialist Fatherland is in Danger Decree. It's got a nice snappy title there. And this basically said, right, anyone who is seen as a potential enemy can be sent to one of the forced labour camps. Okay, and if they try and resist, they'll be executed. So your choice was go to Siberia in one of these gulags where you'll be forced to work in brutal conditions and you'll probably die, or you're going to be executed now. And again, it was a means of removing all the middle classes, anyone who wasn't seen as a worker in the factories. Eventually, this will be extended out to anyone who is regarded to as an enemy of the revolution. And there's quite a loose definition about this. So you end up, this instigates what's called the Red Terror. Red because that's the colour associated with communism. Terror because, much like the terror in France, people were terrorised. They were terrified and scared because of the brutal and summary executions without any sort of trial or appeal or anything like that. So really, the main focus of this is between September 1918 and February 1919. So as the Civil War is kind of in its most intense stage, you end up with concentration camps set up across northern Russia, even on the Svetsky Islands, which up in the Arctic. I mean, that is brutally cold. And you would have somewhere between 50,000 and 140,000 people being executed. Okay, so that's a significant number in a relatively short period of time, in the space of about 6 months. This was done because of the mistakes that were being made by the new government and under the Civil War. Partly, there had been an assassination attempt in August 1918 by a social revolutionary named Fannye Kaplan, who, I'm not sure if he's related to Father Kaplan. No, probably not. Anyway, Fannye Kaplan had tried to execute Lenin. Lenin survived, but he said, no, you're trying to assassinate Lenin, that's no good. So he was executed. But Lenin then became paranoid and worried that there were opposition that would be willing to, you know, execute him. And he didn't like this idea. So the Red Terror is instituted, partly out of that fear, but also because the Civil War wasn't necessarily going well. There was the humiliation from Brest-Litovsk. Prices were going up. Food hadn't increased to the cities. Lots of people were actually saying, does Lenin know what he's doing? And maybe the Bolsheviks don't have all the answers. And so this was a panicked measure to try and stop any hint of opposition from growing. Now, the Red Terror officially ends in 1919, but the arrests and executions will carry on. Okay, so officially Lenin ends the Red Terror at a point where things start to go better during the Civil War. But really, this sets a pattern that's going to last until the collapse of the Soviet Union. So this is all pretty brutal. Now, it leads to a number of oppositions. Oh, I should say as well, one of the things that people were really unhappy about was this economic policy of war communism. And that led to huge revolts and protests by peasants as well. So another reason for the Red Terror was the unpopularity of the economic policy of war communism, which I shall cover in a future episode. But yeah, this terror caused even more opposition to grow. And eventually you end up with, it actually develops opposition. So one of the big outcomes was a group of people called the Workers' Opposition, that was kind of their title, ends up being formed to demand higher wages, better conditions, more food and workers' control over industry. Now just think about that. Under the Bolshevik rule, a group of people have formed in opposition to the Bolsheviks. Bolsheviks meant to be the champions of the factory workers who'd promised bread, peace and... what was the other one? Peace, bread and... I can't remember. What was the third? Peace, bread. Oh, I can't remember. Anyway, peace and bread. That was the main thing. Oh, that's really bad that I forgot that. I'll need to check that. Anyway, but peace and bread. They promised better conditions for workers, better food and so on. But now here is a group of workers forming, demanding the exact thing the Bolsheviks had promised, but campaigning against the Bolsheviks. So this shows just how far off their original aim the Bolsheviks had gone in their pursuit of total control. One of their leaders was Alexandra Kolontae. I'm not sure I've said that right, but anyway. She was actually a Bolshevik. So, you know, there's divisions within the Bolshevik party. They objected to the mass arrests and the ideas of the Cheka to terrify people into submission. And people said, no. This Bolshevik thing and this new communist party that's being created out of the Bolshevik is wrong. We need to get rid of it. So that shows the depth of antipathy and hatred that's developed during the 1921 in reaction to the Red Terror. And perhaps the most significant event is the Kronstadt naval mutiny. Okay, now... the Kronstadt naval base, so that's where there's a lot of soldiers. It's near Kronstadt, which is an island just outside Petrograd. This is a big uprising against the communist dictatorship, okay? And they actually claimed that, what's the quote I've got here? Life under the yoke, kind of the big wooden thing that you use for oxen dragging plows. Life under the yoke of the communist dictatorship has become more terrible than death, which is, you know, bad. Now, why is this so humiliating? I mean, it's a major military threat, you know, because they're a naval base, they've got the weapons, they've got the equipment and the know-how, but it's particularly humiliating because It was the naval base at Kronstadt. It was the same sailors and military people who had been adamant supporters of the Bolsheviks during the October Revolution in 1917. Okay, now, the men had changed and there had been personnel changes. But nevertheless, the fact that the Kronstadt naval base, or the Kronstadt mutiny, has kicked off, synonymous with a group of people that had fought to get the Bolsheviks into power and is now rebelling against the Bolsheviks, shows just how much opposition had grown towards the Bolsheviks from their own key and core supporters. And it's telling, you know, what did the Kronstadt sailors in 1921 demand? They wanted new elections to the Soviets by secret ballot to get rid of the intimidation by the Bolsheviks. They wanted freedom of speech and freedom of the press for all left-wing parties. So maybe not universal, but for the left-wing parties. They wanted free trade unions and peasant organisations. They wanted to end the commissars, okay, this sort of system of ministers, the dictatorship of the proletariat, if you like, in the army and navy. They wanted an end to war communism, the grain requisitioning squads that were seizing grain from the peasants. I will talk about that in the future. And they want all government restrictions on trade to be lifted. Basically, the demands aren't unreasonable. And it's the kind of thing the Bolsheviks had promised and had gone against. So it shows in the space of really three and a half years how far during this period of crisis the Bolsheviks had drifted from their original goal, and how much suffering there were. As ever, how did Lenin and his supporters deal with this? Well, they turned around and said, well, the Kronstadt sailors are really whites. They're supporters of the whites, the counter-revolutionaries. And this just isn't true. Okay, they were Russian workers, working class sailors. Okay, pretty much, although different individuals, pretty much the same people that had been there in the early days, and they felt they had been betrayed by the Bolsheviks, particularly those that had families in the Ukraine and other parts of Russia that were at the time that were really suffering. And the striking workers in Petrograd, had appealed to sailors for help to improve their working conditions. So these are not whites, these are not people trying to impose the Tsar. These are extreme left-wing supporters who want the best for the workers and the peasants. And they feel so strongly they end up in open mutiny and rebellion against the Bolsheviks. Now, the evidence we have is a bit scattered and subjective, but it does seem that really what the Kronstadt sailors wanted was a discussion to change policy rather than to actually overthrow the revolution. You know, and they people say the fact that they did this while their ships were frozen in the ice, so they certainly weren't going to be able to, you know, launch a full-on military attack on Petrograd, is proof that they didn't really want a revolution. You know, if they really wanted a revolution, they could have done it, and they would have waited till their ships were out of the ice, so waited till the summer. But yeah, that doesn't really matter. The intention, in a sense, doesn't matter. It was crushed. It was seen as an enemy. They were acting against the Bolsheviks. And so the Red Army, under the control of Kautsky and using the Cheka, actually came across the sea ice. So they just walked to the island and attacked the sailors firsthand. So again, this is not whites, but they're being attacked as if they were whites. The sailors did fight back, but weight of numbers in the end told against them, and they were defeated. Hundreds of them were killed. Some fled to Finland. More were captured and later executed by the Cheka. Others will end up in concentration camps across the north of Russia. So it ends up being no major consequence coming from it, but symbolically, it has a big effect, okay? It leads to Lenin realizing he needs to change direction. And we'll see that in the economic policy, okay? He realizes he's gone too far. And although the Kronstadt mutiny has been dealt with in a military style, he realizes, right, we need to get a grip on things. We need to change the course we're going in because we're just making enemies for ourselves. So it does have an important legacy in that sense. And will lead to the new economic plan going forward. But that's more for the future time. But in terms of authority and control, the Bolsheviks remain very much in power, and they've removed yet another potential group of people that could have removed them. Anyway, final sort of thing. Although initially the Bolsheviks had seized power through setting up through the sort of leadership of the Union of Soviets, the Bolsheviks, or Lenin, is going to start a process of centralizing power on the party and to himself, and very much focused on the capital, Moscow. So in March 1918, they officially changed their name from Bolsheviks to the Russian Communist Party. Okay, and although people will still call them Bolsheviks, and people, you know, used it as a term of abuse for a long time, officially they were then the Communists, and that was to try and link them more to Marx's ideals and Marx's original thinking. The evidence suggests Lenin and Trotsky and others genuinely believe they were working to create an ideal socialist state based on Marx's principles, and that after this period of hardship, Russia would become the first truly communist country in the world, and everyone will realise how wonderful it is and cooperate to build a classless society, working in each other's interests. Unfortunately, that might have been the hope and the belief, but that's not what actually happened, and that's kind of the story of the next phase of Russia. Russia ends up just becoming a brutal dictatorship. Now, Lenin is kind of the key figure in creating this, even though people will maybe see Stalin as the key figure. He was the leader and the leading member of the Communist Party. He was the chairman of the Council of People's Commissars in Sovnarkom, basically like prime minister. And he was, for a long time, he was the party. He was the kind of leading light and the leading spirit. And so it was under him that a centralized dictatorship grew to control Russia, because Lenin thought only he had the answers, and so he dominated the whole system, and he created a system where he basically was in charge, and if he didn't like something, it didn't happen, and he used the party to instill that leadership. Now, although Lenin will eventually have a stroke and die in the short term, shortly after everything that's gone on here, it provides a model of dictatorship that will be emulated by Stalin going forward. So he does centralize the dictatorship, and he keeps political rivals under control and makes sure they're out of power. Lenin very much wanted to be at the heart and center of everything, which is again a sign of total control, and very much a dictatorship. Lenin believed everything had to come through him. Only he had the answers and the ability to save Russia. Okay, and in order to centralize, although the Soviets were basically, you know, councils within each individual city across Russia, and they claimed they were, you know, the Bolsheviks had claimed when they came to power they were doing it on behalf of the Soviets, you know, kind of indicated that they were going to allow the Soviets control. When they seized power, they only really did that as an expedient method. Okay, the Bolsheviks will end up dominating the sort of all Russian Congress, the Soviets that I mentioned in a previous podcast, and really because all the leading figures of the all party, the all Soviet, or the all Russian Congress of Soviets, and basically banning all the other parties, all the other Soviets, will all be Bolsheviks. The Communist Party, sorry. So really, that means the Communist Party decides things, not the Soviets. The Soviets made up of Bolshevik Party members. Sorry, I will say communists from now on. The Soviet leadership and council is made up of communists. They answer first and foremost to the Communist Party leadership. So really, the Soviets are not acting independently or acting in the interests of their people. They're acting under the orders of the Communist Party. And the Communist Party is controlled by Lenin. So it's this party discipline and party control centered on one person that allows dictatorship to grow. The Soviets will basically become what we call a rubber stamp. Okay, they're basically there to just agree the decisions made by the Communist Party. And that's why it's the leader of the Communist Party that actually controls what's going on. And that's why you'll end up with a system where you have presidents or leaders of the individual Soviets, sort of think Cold War. The first Soviet would be Russia, and then you'd have other Soviets like Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, etc. All these different Soviets would have their own president and their own leader, and in theory were autonomous, but really it was the leader of the Communist Party who told them what to do. And it's when the Communist Party falls and disintegrates in 1991, that the Soviets break away and create their own new republics, okay, and break away from this control. But that's for another story. Now, what this means is it looks like you have a form of democracy where you have all these sort of Soviets which are elected, and they elect all Russian Congress Soviets to make the national laws. So it's kind of like a system of elections. And, you know, it's through the Soviets that you get the Council of People's Commissars. So it looks like you might have a democracy as we would understand it. Oh, I've got a ring. Oh, I do apologise for that short interlude. Yes. It's quite surprising I had a ring at the door. So it looked like it, but realistically it's the Communist Party, and only Communist Party members can stand in elections. So yeah, there were elections, but you had to be a loyal Communist Party member to stand in the elections. So it's the Communists that control everything, and it's the Communist Party Congress that will decide the policies of the party. The Central Committee runs different parts of the parties, and ultimately the top level of the party is a group called the Politburo, and they make the decisions for the party. So the Soviets are really a part of the party structure. They're not independent at all. And it's the Politburo, through its leadership of the party, that controls everything. So we end up with a one-party state that controls everything and controls all the political apparatus, and anyone that criticizes or doesn't show active support for the Communist Party will be removed, will be intimidated and executed and live in fear. Personal and political freedoms are massively reduced throughout this period as the Communist Party tightens its control over people. Now there'll be a party congress, a meeting of the party figures every year, okay? So and that's where they'd elect the Central Committee and make decisions for the next year until the next party congress. So in theory, there were representatives there. The Central Committee would then elect the Politburo that makes up the most influential people. Now, the first Politburo in 1917, and I'm just going to say these names because it's worth bearing in mind for the future, were Lenin, OBS, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Trotsky and Stalin. Okay. So you got these five key members of the original Politburo. These are kind of like the major five. There will then be someone called Bukharin who will join the Politburo, and the Politburo's numbers will expand and decrease as time goes by. But basically, these are the key leading figures. And as the party becomes the dominant instrument, so the Politburo becomes more and more important. Till eventually, the Central Committee that chose these members basically ends up doing whatever the Politburo decides. So being in the Politburo is kind of like being in the cabinet in British government, I suppose you'd say, but even more powerful, and you get to tell everyone what to do. So that's the system of party control. So the last little bit here on control is you end up with the formation of what we would call the USSR. Okay. In 1924, after the victory in the Civil War and everything else, they looked at the system of the old Russian Empire and how it was ruled, and they renamed it, okay? Kind of a branding exercise, because it couldn't carry on being the Russian Empire, now it was communist. So it would be known as the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, okay? Which is, and it's fine to say USSR or Soviet Union there. Originally, this is made up of four Soviet Socialist Republics, okay? The biggest, the first Soviet, would be the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic, basically Russia. And that was absolutely huge and was basically most of the old Tsarist Empire, which would go from sort of European area around Moscow all the way to Vladivostok and the Pacific Ocean. So it was the main one. Basically, it is modern Russia, as we would know it. With, I mean, there's a few other bits as well. So that was huge. Okay, so that's the first Soviet. Now, you might be saying, but hang on, weren't the Soviets coming out of the city? Yes. But the this was the creation of a Soviet just means a council meeting of key figures. So really, it's kind of like a Russian parliament, okay, but in a very working class sense. So the Soviet is created to govern the first Soviet being Russia. Okay, so it would have its leaders and everything underneath, but they were all subservient to the Communist Party that oversaw that. So that's the big one, Russia as we would know it. To the west of it, if you look at a map, still pretty much on that western side, was Belarus. Okay, the second Soviet, the Belarusian Soviet, not a bit smaller than modern, but basically what we now know as Belarus as an independent state. To the south was the Ukrainian Socialist Soviet Republic, or Soviet Socialist Republic, sorry. So that would be the third. And the fourth was the Transcaucasian Republic, which would kind of basically be the areas around the Caucasus. So places like Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan, they were kind of all lumped together there. So initially, these were the first four republics. So that's the Union. Now, as the Soviet Union will expand and it will have administrative changes, it will end up, I think it gets to about 15 or 16, but I could be wrong there, you know, different Soviet republics. But overall, the USSR will remain the same and Russia will remain the largest and dominant voice of all these Soviet socialist republics. OK, that's all. Don't worry too much. If you're doing an exam or something and you write Russia instead of USSR, you're not going to be marked too harshly on that one. But, you know, for accuracy's sake, it is the USSR we're talking about. In the same way, if you're talking about Britain, you should be talking about the UK, the United Kingdom. Yeah, if you call it England, England is, you know, like the biggest and dominant body within the United Kingdom. But the United Kingdom is not just England. So in the same way, although Russia is by far the biggest and dominant part of the USSR, it is not the only part of the USSR. So although people will quite often say Russian, it should be Soviet or the USSR that you're referring to. Anyway, Russia will dominate the other Soviet Socialist Republic, even though essentially they're just meant to be, you know, all voluntary members and on an equal basis and footing. But realistically, most of the Soviets really all came to the USSR as a result of the Red Army, particularly in Ukraine and the Transcaucasus region, and to a degree Belarus. So the kind of main decision-making body of the USSR was, if we call it a parliament like that, it was known as the All-Union Congress of Soviet, or just the Congress of Soviets. But it only meets for a few days in the year, and basically to choose the Council of Commissars and do what it's told by the Central Committee of the party. So really, it's a Politburo that is running things on a day-to-day, all of which is controlled by the Communist Party leadership. So in December 1925, the Communist Party changed its name to the All-Union Communist Party of Bolsheviks to reflect the fact that it now claimed to be the ruling party across all the parts of the USSR. And union was added to try and suggest that it was an equality, it was a union. Everyone had joined together willingly and it was representative of all the groups, even though in truth, it wasn't a union, it had been imposed on these different regions and areas. Okay, so that's really, during the course of the Civil War, how we end up going from all these lofty ideas of equality and freedom and so on, to the creation and establishment of a totalitarian dictatorship. Lenin himself will die in 1924, and Stalin will then take this on when he seizes control of power later on. That's certainly for a future episode. Next time, I'm going to have a look at the economic stuff. Hopefully not quite such a long episode. They're sneaking up in time, I've realised. But we'll look at war communism, and then the new economic plan. And we'll also look at something called state capitalism. So the economic development that was in the background during the Civil War and the Red Terror. So I hope that's been not too excruciating and has given you some food for thought. And yeah, if you didn't know, has helped you understand how things developed. Take care and good luck to you in all your endeavours. Bye.